Well, good evening. It's our custom to start here on time, and welcome to the fifth presentation in this, our 11th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the striped back there, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster taking pictures, Haiwong Wan, and our instruction coordinator at the back, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Atz. Our speaker tonight has lived in a number of states, but has now lived in Kentucky longer than any other. Her interest in folk studies developed when she was in college. She received her BA from the State University of New York at New Paltz, where she studied women's studies, anthropology, and sociology. She later enrolled in the folk studies program at Western Kentucky University, receiving her MA in 1999. After working for the Kentucky State Government in Frankfort, she entered the doctoral program at The Ohio State University, receiving her PhD in English with a specialty in folklore in 2009 for a dissertation, Replacing Tobacco on Kentucky Farms, Discourses of Tradition, Heritage, and Agricultural Diversification. She joined the faculty of WKU in 2010 and is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Folk Studies and Anthropology, where she teaches classes on folk narrative, foodways, women's folklore, and urban folklore. She began research with Kentucky burley tobacco growers in 2005, conducting ethnographical fieldwork in central and northern Kentucky, the center of the burley tobacco production region in Kentucky. During her research, she spent time on farms, observing, and sometimes even participating in tobacco production. She also visited public and private sites related to tobacco and examined the printed literature from the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. The focus of her talk tonight, based on her recent book, Burley, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2013, will be to share a retrospective on how people involved in the industry have viewed their past and their connections to it, and what the implications of its decline are for Kentucky farmers and Kentucky's economy and culture. Please give a warm welcome to Ann Farrell. Ann?
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here and to see many friendly and familiar faces, and also many faces that aren't familiar. Thank you so much for being here tonight. How many of you have raised tobacco at some point in your life, or have family who have? Wow, so quite a number of you. I have not, and don't have family who raise tobacco. And I always like to start out by being upfront that I come to this topic as an outsider, which I think gave me the ability to see things as an outsider, and of course to never fully see things as an insider. I think that's an important thing to know about the perspective that I offer to this topic. And as Brian says, when I add up all the time I've spent in Kentucky, this is not consecutive, but I have lived in Kentucky longer than anywhere else. And I lived here in the late 1990s and early 2000s. For those of you who also did, you know that there were some major events happening related to tobacco production. And so those events are what really spurred my interest in the topic of burley tobacco. Those two events, one was the Master Settlement Agreement in 1998, the $206 billion Master Settlement Agreement between 46 states' attorney general and 46 states' attorney general and the major tobacco companies. I'm not going to talk about that tonight. There were major economic and cultural implications of that agreement, which was the largest civil suit ever settled in this country. I talk about those implications somewhat in the book. The second event was, of course, the tobacco buyout that took place in 2004, and that I will talk quite a bit about. So these were the two things happening in the late 90s and early 2000s, and that, as I said, sort of spurred my interest eventually in the topic. But what I was to find out that those are just the major public changes that happened to tobacco, and so many, many other things changed. So I began this research, as Brian said, in about 2005, the year after the buyout. Primarily, my research was in the bluegrass region. That way, not the screen, right? So those, if you can see, the grayed-in counties were the primary areas of my research where I spent time and interviews and so forth. And it's also just important for those of you who don't know me to say briefly that I am a folklorist. So that means a number of things, but briefly, one thing that means is that my approach to research is about talking with people about their traditions and learning from them. So in the case of this research, of course, talking with tobacco producers and others who are experts on this topic and learning from them, and participant observation. I did, as Brian mentioned, do some tobacco work and so forth. So that's one thing that's important to know. The other thing is that my interest is really in tobacco as a traditional cultural practice. And so coming to it, that's the sort of perspective, the lens that I brought to and I bring to this topic. So tonight I'm going to mostly talk and occasionally read some short snippets from the book just to tease you, because there will be some for sale afterwards. I'm indebted to the first tobacco farmer I interviewed as I began this research in 2005, the late Robert Taylor of Bracken County, in part because he provided me with the knowledge I needed in order to ask my future interviewees much more informed questions than those that I asked him. But he also asked me an important question. Following a driving tour of the Taylor farm that included his cattle and pastures, his tobacco barns, his garden, and of course his tobacco crop, we sat down in the living room for an interview and had this exchange. I said, and one of the things that you talked about during our farm tour is the different parts of the process. And I wonder if you would walk me through the whole year, all the parts of that process. And Mr. Taylor said, okay, I'll do my best. Would you rather have present day or olden days? There's a whole lot of difference. And I replied that I wanted him to tell it to me the way that he thought it should be told, but that perhaps he might tell me both. Mr. Taylor's question stayed with me, but it was a while before I realized that he had given me the narrative structure of the story of tobacco in the early 21st century, a narrative woven together out of threads of change. While most farmers didn't ask me directly if I wanted to hear about present day or olden days, as Bob Taylor did, most offered me a comparative narrative that included how things are done today and how they were done during other periods. Many also shared both questions and predictions about tobacco's future. The tobacco buyout of 2004, which again, as I will discuss, ended the federal tobacco price support program that had been in place since the New Deal era, is widely understood as a dramatic moment of change and transition for Kentucky agriculture. And although transition in its current usage most often refers explicitly to the aftermath of the buyout, tobacco production can more generally be understood as tradition in process, ever-changing, continually transitioning. This book unravels multiple threads of change within the lifetimes of present-day farmers in order to understand how those threads have been woven together into a complex whole. So Burley, the book, is about changes that have taken place, as I said, over the second half of the 21st century and into the 21st, and even more so, it's about how farmers talk about those changes. Yet a very brief overview of sort of tobacco history, but really of the narratives that are most often talked about in terms of how important historically tobacco has been, both in the U.S. generally and in Kentucky. I'm going to give just a brief bit of that as context for the more recent history that I will be focused on. Tobacco has been called America's oldest industry because of its economic role in America before and since the European discovery of the plant among first contact with Native Americans, at which time it had long been a major item of trade between Native American peoples. As early as 3000 BCE, Native Americans were smoking tobacco for a variety of ritual, social, and diplomatic purposes, as well as for personal pleasure, and were also using the plant for a number of medicinal purposes throughout the Americas. Christopher Columbus first mentioned these strange dry leaves that appeared to be of great importance to the Indians in a diary entry written in 1492. Although the first gift of tobacco he received was said to have been thrown overboard, since he and his crew did not know what it was or what to do with it. Over the course of the 16th century, tobacco spread across Europe, Asia, and Africa, largely through the agency of traders and sailors who carried the weed and the habit of using it in various ways throughout the world. The survival of Jamestown after two failed attempts is attributed to John Rolfe's
successful development of the crop, opening the way for further settlement of the continent. Rolf made his first attempt to grow a crop of tobacco in 1612, and in the year 1618, Virginians raised 20,000 pounds. By 1664, 24 million pounds of tobacco were being exported from the colonies to England. Tobacco warehouses were one of the first businesses to be regulated in colonial North America. And tobacco, it is frequently argued, helped to fund the American Revolution. And in the earliest days of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, receipts given as proof of stored tobacco could serve as currency. It was, of course, in the 18th century that we, as we know, Kentucky eventually became a state in 1792, but as Virginians moved west to what is now Kentucky, they brought tobacco farming with them. It was during the 19th century that distinct types of tobacco with different uses and purposes, began to settle into particular regions of the U.S. And I don't know how well you'll be able to see this. I'm stepping away from the microphone, sorry.
But as you can see, of course, here we are. This is the Burley Belt. The largest type of tobacco now raised is flue cured or bright tobacco, which is over in the Carolinas and so forth. And there are a number of other types of tobacco, all with particular purposes and different production practices and therefore different cultures surrounding them. So Burley tobacco, which is of course what this book is about, settled primarily in Kentucky and parts of Tennessee. There are other small regions of Burley elsewhere. And in the 19th century, the way of using tobacco for the most part was chewing it. And Burley was really good for chewing tobaccos. And the type of Burley, and this is a very interesting sort of legend that exists in a couple of different versions that I talk about in the book. The type of Burley that is now grown, or the ancestor to what is now grown, was discovered in 1865. And it was a particularly good type of tobacco, again, for chaw, because of it had less sugar in the leaf, it absorbed sweeteners that were added to flavor it, it blended well. And it also had aspects of it in terms of how it was grown and cured and so forth that made it more efficient for farmers, because it could be, for instance, the entire stalk could be cut, which is called stalk cut, instead of priming, which in the flue-cured region, tobacco is primed, which means the leaves are pulled off one grade at a time instead of the whole stalk being cut off. So Burley had a number of things about it that were an improvement on the former type of Burley tobacco that had been grown. So that's in 1865 and after. excuse me. And then in the 1880s, cigarette consumption really starts to get going, helped in part by the invention of the cigarette rolling machine in the 1880s. By 1913, there had been, you know, various different types and blends of tobacco. 1913 is when Camels come out. And then by 1917, we have the major types, Chesterfields, Lucky Strikes, and Camels, and the invention of what became known as the American Blend cigarette. And the American Blend was made up of four primary types of tobacco, and you can see up to a quarter of it was Burley tobacco. So between the properties that made it a good thing for chaw and then what made it a good thing for what became the American Blend cigarette really solidified the importance of Burley and therefore the importance of Kentucky as a Burley, as the center of the Burley Belt and as a tobacco producing region. So between 1865 and 1929, Kentucky produced more tobacco by pound than any other state. North Carolina did surpass us in 1929 and has remained the largest tobacco producing state. So despite the increasing rates of smoking and so forth, the prices that tobacco were being paid in the early 20th century were all over the place. It was a tumultuous period, and some of you probably know this very well, and I'm just going to quickly mention that by the late 19th century, the American Tobacco Company had been formed by subsuming over 250 small sort of cottage industry tobacco and some larger, but tobacco companies. They became known as the Tobacco Trust. And so basically they had a monopoly of tobacco, by the buying of tobacco in the U.S. And there was also, and there had been really since Jamestown, there was also a great deal of major overproduction. So between the trust and the overproduction, prices were incredibly low by the early 20th century. There were brief attempts in the first decade of the and in the second decade of the 20th century to create cooperative associations among farmers. The most well-known in western Kentucky and Tennessee was the Dark Fired Tobacco District Planters Protective Association, a mouthful. So that was the period that many of you may have heard of as the Black Patch Wars. Basically, in western Kentucky and Tennessee between 1904 and 1908, a period in which, and this was happening in other periods, but the western Kentucky has become most well-known for the night riders in that region who burned tobacco warehouses, and also for farmers who wouldn't join the cooperative, they burned their tobacco barns, they scraped their plant beds, there were farmers who were murdered, and so forth. So this was a very violent period in tobacco history that ended in western Kentucky anyway around 1908. The Tobacco Trust, meaning the, again, massive American Tobacco Company, dissolved in 1911, but it really just was divided up into four large companies. So this didn't solve the problems entirely, of course. World War I comes along, lots of smoking going on in World War I, rates, the prices, temporarily go up, war ends. Prices drop again. War is very central to the tobacco, the implantment of tobacco history. So by the 1930s, tobacco prices were still really very low. And by the time we get to the 30s, now we're talking about stories that farmers today tell that have been passed through families about those really hard years. One such story, and I should say that these stories often aren't tied specifically to a definite period of time, but they're, they happened sometime in the early century before the tobacco program took place or was in place. One such story appears to have long been in wide circulation, as I've encountered it in both oral and print sources. In this story, a farmer brought his tobacco to the warehouse, only to have it bring less than the fees that he was going to have to pay in order to sell it. The warehouseman told him to bring a chicken in to cover the warehouse fees. So the next day, the farmer came back to the warehouse with two chickens. And when the warehouseman asked him why he had brought two, he replied that he had another load of tobacco to sell. Sometimes that's told as a joke, and it becomes, there's a punchline there, and other times it's told as legend, as I talk about more in the book. Some stories are also more directly tied to family members. So Wilbur Perkins from Franklin County told me a story about how one year his father fit his entire crop into the back seat of his car because it was such a small crop that year. He was then not able to pay off the grocers and the loans that he owed because it brought so little money. So there are stories that are specific to particular family members, as well as stories that that are, again, in legend or joke form and therefore not in the immediate first person or family of the teller. So these are important contexts for, it was during the New Deal that legislation was passed that created the Federal Tobacco Program, part of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and there were various years in which that was updated and so forth. But it created programs for commodities like wheat, milk, tobacco, hogs, rice, and so forth. Again, trying to deal with getting the U.S. out of the Great Depression. And the tobacco program was, of course, complex, but there are two basic parts to understand. One is that there was a base or a quota that, a limit on how much could be raised by on a particular farm. And so prior to the program, if you had raised tobacco, you were given a base or allotment when the program was created. And then that was changed every year according to the demand, most basically. And an allotment or a base was tied to land. So if you bought a farm in Kentucky, there was a very good chance that there was some tobacco base that was tied to that land. And so without that base, you couldn't sell tobacco. You needed that proof of owning that quota in order to sell your tobacco. So farmers agreed to limits on how much they could grow through the quota program in exchange for what was called a support price, which meant that every year, every grade of tobacco, there was a decision made about what the minimum price for that grade would be. And so when a farmer brought the crop to the warehouse, and it was, the auction took place, if there was not a bid for just above the minimum price for that grade, then that tobacco went into what was called the pool. And that was money that was borrowed by, in the case of Burley, the Burley Tobacco Cooperative Growers Association, to buy that tobacco and pay the farmer for it. And then when it was sold to a company eventually, then that money was paid back to the government with interest. So that's an important piece that has long been misunderstood in terms of how the support price worked. At the same time, the system of grading was created as well. And the other thing that the tobacco program meant is that tobacco production didn't move around like some other crops moved around. So we think of cotton as a deep south crop, but actually then it moved in some ways to Arizona and Texas and so forth. Tobacco was tied to land, and so the map that I showed earlier of the types of tobacco really stayed in those places. And so again, unique cultures continued around those particular types of tobacco and the production demands. So it's the end of that program that I just described that's commonly referred to as the buyout. It's been described by ag professionals as one of the most dramatic changes in any U.S. agricultural policy over the last half century, as tobacco now had the distinction of being the only government-supported commodity to move abruptly to an entirely free market policy. So basically, no more support prices, no more quotas. Anybody, anywhere in the U.S. can raise tobacco, if you can get a contract, which is a whole other issue that I talk about in the book. So what this also meant, and another what it meant was that quota owners and tobacco growers over a 10-year period, there was a fund established with money from tobacco manufacturers that provided transition payments over that 10-year period to farmers who owned quota and or who were growing it. And again, that's the quickest explanation I can give for a very complex program and the end of it. So today, since tobacco farmers now contract directly with companies, the buyout also meant the end of the auction system, although it had started to end a few years prior for other reasons. But the tobacco auction, of course, is a very iconic image in American history. When we think of, the Dukes, I forgot a few slides, part of the American Tobacco Company, of course, the Dukes, and that is an image of the Knight Riders. So again, the tobacco auction, those iconic images of the tobacco buyers and the warehousemen, with the great big piles of tobacco, is an image that we I think often think of when we think of tobacco and tobacco history. And at auctions, basically, they were not just moments where farmers sold their crop. They were also very, very social, celebratory times in towns that had tobacco marketing centers. The beginning of the sales period was a really important time for the town under the auction system. Today, the majority of tobacco is sold at receiving stations. Farmers have contracts with a particular tobacco company and bring it and drop it off. So all of those social aspects, all of the performative aspects of selling your tobacco, of the tobacco auction, of the chant, are mostly gone. There are a handful of auctions that are left, still holding small-scale auctions in Kentucky. This is a photo from a warehouse in Danville that still has auctions, and this was in December, this past December. So dramatically different image, dramatically different environment from the historical auctions, and yet really important for some farmers who choose not to contract with tobacco companies, or who have more than their contracts, more than they contracted for. So the other thing, of course, that happened at the buyout is that some farmers got out of tobacco. Some retired, some moved more fully into off-farm work. A lot of them did, have a lot more cattle, so they put their energy into other aspects of their operations. Some really quick statistics, just to see, this is the U.S., not just Kentucky, but the 50s were really the peak of tobacco production in the U.S. There were over 500,000 tobacco farms in the U.S. By 2002, that was down to 56,000, and 2007, there were just over 16,000. Now, the farms in 1954 were a lot smaller, so that, is not a as direct in terms of how much tobacco is being produced, but tobacco in is now grown, in other parts of the world much more than it would have been at that time. This is also just really important to keep in mind. In 1959, there was tobacco growing on 80% of the farms in Kentucky. So when we think of, when we talk about a tobacco culture, it's important to keep in mind that it was much more normal to grow tobacco than not to grow tobacco. And I think today we may not be as aware of that. So by 2007, the year, as I was doing my research, this is the last census of agriculture, there were over 8,000 farms that on which tobacco was still being grown, which was a surprise when those numbers came out. People thought there were less than that. The 2012 numbers are not yet out. They're supposed to be actually starting to be released next week, so that will be interesting to see. But that's still 10% of farmers. And again, as of 2007, 50% of U.S. tobacco is still raised in Kentucky. So many farmers do continue to raise tobacco. And yet the buyout, of course, brought dramatic changes with it. And again, the book traces some of the threads of these changes. For Kentucky burley tobacco growers, tobacco farming is a livelihood that involves a mastery of traditional skills passed through generations and adapted to changing circumstances, technological, economic, social, and political. And so one of the threads that I pull out in the book are those changes in terms of farm technologies. And I don't have time, certainly, to cover all of those changes or anywhere close to those changes tonight, but I do have one change I just want to describe briefly because it's very emblematic of the kinds of the way that tobacco is talked about in terms of how things have changed over the last half of the 20th century. And that is what's known as the move from tying tobacco in hands to packaging it in bales. So burley tobacco continues to be stripped from the stalk after it's cured by hand. Traditionally, this was done over a period of weeks or months, primarily by family members in what is called a stripping room. Traditionally, a stripping room is a small, narrow, rectangular room about 12 feet wide by 20 feet long, attached to a tobacco barn in which a farmer's tobacco is stripped from the stalk and ready for sale. A great deal of nostalgia pervades descriptions of stripping rooms of the past. Families spent the fall and often much of the winter together in the stripping room, and these times are described as multi-generational, full of stories, warm from the stove, and pervaded by the pleasant smell, as well as the less pleasant dust of cured tobacco. In most cases, the entire family was involved, all ages, all genders. Dinner and supper were sometimes cooked or reheated on the stove. The smallest children played or slept on a corner of the stripping bench. A dog usually lay under the stripping bench. Neighbors stopped by, and the radio, later sometimes a TV, played in the background. Phyllis Sharp, one of the women I interviewed, described at the stripping room, it was like a gathering place in the wintertime with the neighbors. If they weren't stripping or they just wanted to come and hang out, they would come and you would have like a big pot of beans and cornbread or a big pot of chili, a big pot of soup on the old stove in the stripping room. And the radio going, Yeah, it was hard work, but a lot of good memories and a lot of quality time with your family. So those are some of the ways in which stripping rooms were described. As it was stripped from the stock, it was tied again into what were called hands of tobacco. It's most basic. It's a bundle of tobacco that you hold in your hand, and then you use a tie leaf to tie off the end of it when you get that hand tied. And yet, a hand of tobacco is one of the prime examples of the complex system of knowledge of the aesthetics and the skills that were involved and are involved in tobacco production. So it's talked about as very emblematic of that aesthetic system and those skills. Because not just anyone could tie what is called a pretty hand of tobacco. It's a particular skill to know how a good hand should look. And tying hands of tobacco well meant that when you brought it to the warehouse and it was neatly laid out on the baskets in circular rows, that meant pride in your crop, what you'd worked on all year. And it also, and there are debates about this that are fascinating, it might have meant better prices, might not have, depends on who you ask. But certainly it was key to your income as well as your pride. Beginning in the early 1980s, burley tobacco began to be packaged in bales. And this is a complex and absolutely fascinating story. It's a whole other book. I describe some of it in this book. But all the participants are talked about as having been resistant to baling tobacco. This was not the way you treated tobacco. So there were resistance from farmers, from warehouses, from manufacturers, for different reasons. Ultimately, it was more efficient and better economically for all of them. But it, as it's talked about today by some, it took a while to get there. So that's a baling box. I don't know if you can see that, but. So ultimately, those who were farming at the time, saw how it benefited them financially, basically right away, as soon as they got paid for it. And yet it's a symbol of how times have changed in their lifetimes. So for instance, Martin Henson, who was a farmer who I got to know real well, one of my primary teachers, he said to me in one interview, "Things have come a long way. I've often wondered what my daddy would say if he saw me baling tobacco." And I said, "What would he say?" He said, "I don't know." And Martin, as always, is laughing through the entire laughing. "I don't know. He's probably turned over several times." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well," he's not laughing now. He says, "Well, I know for years he raised tobacco. He raised tobacco until he was 84 when he passed away. He raised tobacco for probably 75 years. He hand-tied it. Everything was neat, just prim and proper. Now you just throw it in there and tramper on and go on." And yet, a farmer, while Martin Henson described his father turning over in his grave at the idea of baling tobacco rather than carefully tying it into hands, Clarence Gallagher, a generation younger than Martin, described the neatness of his own father's bales with awe. Clarence described a particularly messy load of tobacco to me that he had seen, and I asked him what his father would have said about it. He told me he wished he had pictures of his father's bales so that he could show me what older people did. And he went on to say that his bales looked like you could just shoot a rifle down the side of them. You know what I mean? He told me that everything was just neat. So that aesthetic that was so important in terms of pride, of tying tobacco into hands, moved and shifted and changed over to bales of tobacco. And so bales still had a particular aesthetic. So that was an important aspect of that change. But the other aspect that's important about the change is that the stripping room has continued to change over the years. Increasingly, people are paid to strip tobacco, and the family, and this is not always the case in those who have small acreages, but the family often does very little. And now there's increasing pressure to bale tobacco in these large bales. These are 500 to 600 pound bales, as opposed to the one I showed earlier, which is about a 90 pound bale. To many, the loss of family time in the stripping room is a primary symbol of how life has changed, what tobacco once meant and what it means today. The change from hands to bales, as well as who strips tobacco, is also talked about as it's very symbolic of the changed meanings of the crop. It's talked about as a time when there was an intimate relationship with the crop, when every leaf was touched multiple times by the farmer and members of the farm family, of a time when the crop was respected as a source of income and a source of pride, of a time when tobacco farmers were respected tobacco men in their communities. And tobacco men is a term that I heard over and over. And Wendell Berry has written about this term, I'm sure many of you are familiar with Wendell Berry from Henry County. He's written, "As a boy and a young man, I worked with men who were as fiercely insistent on the ways and standards of their discipline as artists, which is what they were. In those days, to be recognized as a tobacco man was to be accorded an honor such as other cultures bestowed on the finest hunters or warriors or poets. The accolade, 'He's a tobacco man,' would be accompanied by a shake of the head to indicate that such surpassing excellence was finally a mystery. There was more to it than met the eye." So that's Wendell Berry's description of tobacco man. Tobacco man symbolizes a gendered relationship with the crop. This is not Wendell Berry anymore. This is me. That encompasses the performance of particular skills, knowledge of an aesthetic system, and a type of man who is highly respected in the community. The days of the tobacco man are widely perceived as gone, as there are fewer and fewer tobacco farmers, and as many of those who remain have changed their farming practices. As tobacco became stigmatized, the status of a category of men who were once among the most respected in the community also changed. So again, there are many, many technological changes that farmers have accepted and even initiated over the years, and I describe those in more detail in the book. But I want to point out that despite, I think there are stereotypes as farmers as very resistant to change, and a lot of what farmers told me is that, you know, if something worked and saved me money and time, I'm there, I'm doing it. So I describe some of those changes. An incredibly important thread that I trace in the book is the changed meanings of tobacco, of the crop, and therefore of those who grow it. Tobacco was suspected of being harmful as early as 1604. King James wrote a scathing manifesto against tobacco use in 1604. And there were periods in American history in which it was banned, including in various places and times during the temperance movement. But it was the 1950s and 60s at which the effects of smoking and tobacco use were finally being proven. Or just smoking, actually. Prior to this, however, tobacco was understood very differently. Smoking rates had increased more during World War II than in any other period of American history, and this was good for the Kentucky economy. So in 1951, King Tobacco reigned. This is the cover of the Department of Ag newsletter. It was unquestioned. King Tobacco reigned. And according to the Commissioner of Agriculture at the time, Ben Adams, in 1955, "No other enterprise in our state has as great an influence on the entire economy of Kentucky as the tobacco industry. Naturally, whenever the well-being of the tobacco industry is in jeopardy, it is a matter of concern to everyone." And also in 1955, you can't read this, but at the bottom there, "Kentucky's most profitable tradition." So it's a picture of a field of tobacco. It was understood as the most profitable tradition, right? It wasn't the way that we culturally understand tobacco today had not yet come. But as you may be aware, we've just seen the 50th anniversary of the first report from the Surgeon General on the effects of smoking in 1964, released on a Saturday so that the stock market would not crash. And it made a connection between smoking and lung cancer specifically that was more persuasive than and taken more seriously than other earlier reports. There were a number of reports in the 50s that were pretty darn persuasive as well, but this was the big one. This is often seen as a turning point. It certainly was a turning point in rates of tobacco use. The peak of tobacco use is right at that time, and rates have dropped since then. So as tobacco-related illnesses came to be increasingly understood, of course, the meanings of tobacco changed. And I trace the meanings in some detail over the 20th century in terms of how those changes can be understood. But by the late 1990s, in some cases, tobacco farmers were experiencing stigma and blame, right? So this is a crop that was stigmatized. And I heard things like, one thing that's really changed is when we got married and people raised tobacco, it was a good, honest way to make a living. And at the time that we got out, which was 2003, if you raised tobacco, you were dirt. You know, you were contributing to the cancer. So that's a dramatic change from, say, Wendell Berry's description of a tobacco man and what that meant. And in the book, I also briefly describe some of the ways in which I think the tobacco companies really made that happen. They really made them the face of the industry in their attempts to defend the industry. The idea of tobacco farming as a way of life was really exploited in very visible ways, and farmers were mobilized as citizen lobbyists and really became the face of the industry in ways that helped the public have a real a particular view of tobacco farmers as well as tobacco itself. And as the meanings of tobacco have changed, farmers have increasingly been asked, why don't you just raise something else? And as a contrast to the quote from 1955 that I just read from the Commissioner of Ag, then, in 2004, our former Commissioner of Agriculture, Richie Farmer, wrote, there can be no doubt that Kentucky's agriculture community faces many challenges. Tobacco farmers are moving to diversify their farm operations. And there's a widespread assumption that most are looking for alternatives. You can't really see that in the back, but this is a very common type of headline. Burley cuts spur farmers to open vegetable co-op. So we have this idea that farmers are all running out, leaving tobacco and raising vegetables. And many are. I mean, there have been some really interesting and exciting things happening with farmers who have made the decision to try other things and to locate niche crops and so forth. But for those who continue to grow tobacco, there are as many reasons as there are farmers, and those are both tangible and intangible reasons. And I certainly, again, don't have time to describe all the reasons that I describe in the book. But I asked Franklin County Extension agent Keenan Bishop about the differences between raising tobacco and raising other crops. And he said everything. Because with tobacco, you know, even if you didn't like it or you weren't the best person at it, you grew up, you know, you grew up saturated in it. Your daddy did it, and his daddy did it, all your uncles did it. So you couldn't help but learn how to do it, how to do it right. So, you know, you grew up in that atmosphere, that culture where you could do it with your eyes closed kind of thing. And all the farms were suited for it. All the farms have tobacco barns, and all the farms, you know, have your little patches along the creeks or the ridge tops. You know, to grow the crop, it was a no-brainer kind of thing. So to do anything other than tobacco, you've got to not only relearn, but you've got to regear for it. You know, you may be able to use some of the equipment, but probably not. So some of the real tangible economic reasons that he lists, you know, the land, you know, the amount of land you have, the type of land you have that may be suited for tobacco and cattle and not other things. Equipment and barns often is inherited. But it's rare for somebody to wake up one day and say, I think I'm going to go be a tobacco farmer. They've got the equipment in the barns or access to it in some cases. And so getting new equipment, new types of barns for new crops or a new type of operation is a big investment. Again, there's a particular system of knowledge, both skills that are needed for growing the crop as well as an aesthetic system. I've told many times, tobacco is really not hard to grow. It grows like a weed. But to grow it well and to cure it so that somebody wants to buy it takes a lot of very particular skills, as well as real good luck with climate and with weather and soil and against diseases and so forth. So for the most part, tobacco, as Keenan described, tobacco farmers learned this over the course of their lifetimes. And they can absolutely learn all of those things as they apply to new crops. But it's a very different learning process, you know, an accelerated learning process. Which not all are willing to do. And the other half of that, the other thing that they need is the learning process in terms of marketing. So because, as has been sort of acknowledged, there's no one replacement for tobacco. It's about building markets, finding a niche crop, a way to create your own thing. You need to be an entrepreneur as well as a farmer. And part of the tradition of tobacco farming, because of the marketing system, has been no need to market. You with the tobacco program, there was no marketing needed. Tobacco could sit in the barn until it was ready to sell, and you had somebody there ready to buy it. So the ability to go out and create markets, to nurture markets, is a particular skill. And tobacco farmers have, in fact, tried many crops over the years. They have constantly tried new crops to supplement their income and so forth. And I heard a lot of stories that I started calling failed diversification efforts about attempts. So often I'd ask an extension agent or a farmer if they knew anyone who tried something new, and I was told stories about someone who had tried bell peppers, Jerusalem artichokes, watermelons, exotic animals such as ostriches, only to see the experiment end in failure. Former tobacco farmer Phil Sharp responded to this question with this humorous narrative about a farmer who tried to raise cucumbers. The farmer said he was picking cucumbers. He said there was a little one down there, the right size to pick. And he raised up and lit a cigarette. He reached back down there, and it had got too big. And, you know, so, you know, the story, and a lot of the stories are about, you know, that with vegetables, you've got to have them ready when the market is ready, or they turn to mush. They're done, right? And which was not the case with tobacco. Tobacco doesn't turn to mush. Most consistently, in terms of economic and tangible reasons, I was told that tobacco continues to pay more per acre for many farmers than any other farm products would. And it depends on the farmer's operation, but in many cases, that's the reason. There are a lot of intangible reasons as well. And again, just as some examples, the rhythm of life. Tobacco and cattle and hay have long been raised together. Because when work needs to be done in one, the other may be in sort of a slower time. And so there's a particular rhythm of life in on the daily sense, but tobacco is also often described as a 13-month crop, because as you're finishing up the last year's crop, you're starting the next one, and the 13-month description also alludes to the intensity of the fact that you're always doing something in tobacco. There's not a time when you're not doing something or thinking about it. And so that's important. It's also often described, that 13-month cycle is described in terms with particular references to holidays, which I think are symbolically important. The idea that often you were setting tobacco by Memorial Day. You wanted to be cutting and housing by Labor Day. You're often stripping tobacco on Thanksgiving. You wanted to have it sold by Christmas, but if not, then you were stripping it at Christmas. And I think those mentionings of holidays in that 13-month cycle shows how tobacco is so wound up in all aspects of life, the mundane and the sacred. Right? So that's a symbolic way in which the rhythm of life is so connected with tobacco. And then, of course, there are aspects of, as I've hinted, of identity and understanding of tradition and heritage. And the idea that their fathers and grandfathers were tobacco men, and becoming a tomato man or a pepper man, see, not the same thing, right? It's important to understand that I'm not saying that that's the only reason someone would continue to raise it. And farmers told me that quite frequently. You know, nobody's stupid enough to keep growing it if they're not getting paid for it. But all those reasons and many, many more, you know, come together and are intrinsically linked together. And so while I think part of the public talk about tobacco, it's easy to pick out reason by reason and say why this shouldn't matter. It's the linking together of all of those things that make tobacco continue to make sense for many, many farmers. And so, like the threads of change that I attempted to unravel since my first interview with a tobacco farmer, all of these things are interconnected. And I'm wrapping up. The tobacco market is still thought of as relatively stable, despite the fact that in this free market system, it's a very different environment. But Roger Quarles in Scott County told me, you know, most markets work in cycles. That's one thing about the tobacco market. It's very steady. It plods along, and it doesn't have these huge swings. Cattle were up a year ago. Now they're not worth raising, according to some people. And goats fit the same thing. Any crop you pick will almost fit those cycles. But tobacco, it's a very, very dependable crop to put out, It's one of the very few I know of that you can have some reasonable expectation about what your income is going to be this coming year. I mean, you're not going to get enough to, you know, get rich in any one year, but then, you know, you're not going to go broke either. You're not subject to the market swings that some of these other crops are. And in fact, in the last couple of years, prices have gone up, and they're now up past the pre-buyout prices for the first time in 10 years. So even in this riskier free market environment, for many farmers, tobacco continues to be the crop that makes the most sense. And finally, the following exchange took place in early 2008 during an interview I conducted with Jonathan Schell and his grandfather, G.B., with whom I had visited many times over the previous year. I said to Jonathan, "I was asking your granddad what he thought about me coming down and learning from y'all for almost a year." And he said, "Well, I like it. I hope you romanticize tobacco in your book and you get published. That way people will start loving it." And I said, "So you think I should romanticize it?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "What does that mean?" And he said, "Just make it intimate, to where that they can see that, you know, there's hands that touch this stuff and there's lives that are dependent on it." And my goal in this book has certainly not been to romanticize tobacco farmer, and I firmly believe I've not done that. But I do hope that I've succeeded in demonstrating that there's hands that touch this stuff and there are lives that are dependent on it. Thank you.
We have time for questions. Yes.
Is there like gourmet tobacco places that still tie it? Is gourmet the right word? Are there traditional tobacco places that tie it? I don't know.
That's a question we can talk about, Della, at another time. I mean, it's not as easy as going from tying a hand of tobacco to smoking. But yes, I mean, there are certainly, I mean, there's, you know, you've probably heard of American Spirits. There's a sort of move of natural and organic tobaccos, and R.J. Reynolds owns them now, but that started out as more of a gourmet.
Right here.
Evaluate earthworms as an alternative to tobacco. I ask this because my Kentucky history class tried it once. We had Daniel Boone and Henry Clay. We named them all.
And how'd they do? Well, sounds like you know more about earthworms than I do, I guess.
Well, we had to take them home on the weekends, just like the, you know, kids in grammar school. We did quite well until it was my weekend and I killed them.
Sounds like a risky alternative then.
Yeah,
but
back
do you here. Think earthworms may be the answer?
I don't think there's any one answer, and I honestly don't know enough about earthworms, but I think part of what, you know, a lot of, again, the public discussion has been, what is the answer? And there's not one answer. I think every farmer, for some farmers, the answer is tobacco. And that's something that I really want to stress, that that's what makes the most sense. But for other people who want to try other things, there are all kinds of things that they're figuring out to do that are as interesting as earthworms.
Yes.
What about non-marijuana hemp? Yeah. As a good crop to replace tobacco. I mean, Kentucky was the hemp producer of
before tobacco.
I've always been on the impression tobacco kind of replaced hemp when hemp went out of, you know, became illegal.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah.
Yeah, and then a lot of those hemp farmers became tobacco. Yeah. Is it now time for tobacco farmers to go back to being hemp farmers?
Well, and I've heard multiple perspectives on that from farmers as this discussion has gone on the last year or so. Martin Henson, who I mentioned and who is very much in the book, who is now in his mid-70s, and is good friends with somebody else I interviewed who's in his 90s. And he apparently wants nothing more than to grow a crop of hemp before he dies. And so he and Martin are really hoping to grow some hemp together. Younger farmers who I've talked to have talked about, you know, the economically, they're really questioning whether or not, certainly per acre, it doesn't compare at all. With the tobacco income. So it's not a direct replacement, but I think there are those who will be interested in trying it. But I think it's interesting that the older guys who remember stories from their dads or granddads about...
It's a very profitable product.
Yeah, yeah. So it's going to be really interesting to see, and we seem to be getting a little closer.
You talk a bit about migrant labor and when that becomes important. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and that was what's important to... Tobacco is talked about historically as a family crop, and yet it clearly there was always some paid labor at different times of the year. And I think part of the nostalgia around it is the importance of remembering it as a family crop, because it was so important to the family. But there have always been, whether it was the woman down the road who was a widow who helped, paid her to help strip, or further east, they talked about the boys from the mountains who come at cutting and housing time to help harvest the crop. So there was always some paid labor, and most of the paid labor were the teenage boys, your son and your son's friends and so forth. There are different sort of ways in which it's explained why that labor is not there anymore. But by the 80s, there was active recruitment of labor from Mexico and Latin America. And I think that's a story we're not told either, that that was really actively recruited, because there was a need. There was a serious labor shortage. Farmers couldn't get their crop in. That became a really key part of tobacco production. And certainly, there are particular narratives of undocumented workers and their treatment. And we all know that there is horrific treatment of undocumented workers in some cases. But there are also some fabulous stories about workers who come back every single year to the same farm. Farmers who have traveled to Mexico to meet the families of the workers who they've come to become very close with. That's also a very complex picture that we're given a particular picture of that's not always the same.
Back here.
I was wondering if any of the current farmers how they deal with the problems. How they still grow it and how they deal with it.
Yeah, it's still legal. I mean, that really, which I say that, shortly, but they really do say, it is still legal and I'll grow it as long as it's legal, which I think really reflects that symbolically they've been made to feel almost criminal for growing it. Right? If their only defense can be it's still legal, then that means, and a lot of, farmers who are still raising it don't necessarily want to talk about or talk about stigma, right? That came mainly from farmers who had retired or from extension agents. Those who are still raising it, it's legal, and I'm paying my bills. Is that?
Time for one more question.
Struck me as how, having been growing up in a farm family, we now raise vegetables in Canada, and how mechanized that industry was.
Yeah.
How unmechanized tobacco production
is. Burley, absolutely. I mean, compared to flue cured, which I showed in the Carolinas, has been mechanized in a lot of ways for years. And so the harvest is mechanized. There's several aspects of the work that in Burley and some other types of tobacco is still absolutely done by hand. And so that idea of passing through the field over and over to do various aspects of the work, because Burley, and there are different arguments, and again, a longer story that's somewhat in the book about why Burley hasn't been mechanized. It's a combination of the uniqueness of the plant and the belief that, it just can't be mechanized. It wouldn't do. So yeah, it is. It's fascinating.
You mentioned even the gender stereotype. The men always drove the tractors. I found that tricky. Women might be by setting.
Women often help set, and still do help set to that.
Which is a tough thing to do, and the men were driving the tractors.
Well,
on behalf of our friends' organization, our genial host here at Barnes & Noble, we want to especially thank Professor Farrell for coming out.